Well, I guess things could always get worse. Oh my God, they just did. Here comes the Colonel.
Welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow, the definitive radio program on emerging science, open innovation, and nanotechnology. In this half hour, we're going to continue our conversation with Chris McMurrow. He's with University of Texas at Arlington and their Automation and Robotics Research Institute, who's hosting the robotics competition at the IEEE Green Technology Conference in mid-April, sponsored by Encore. So we're going to finish our conversation with Chris, and also stopping by is going to be David Welsh. David is fascinating. His organization, OptiSense, has developed these sensors and is continuing to develop these sensors that work on the transmission lines and give vital information to the power companies. And he's going to explain a little bit about the things that he's doing. So remind you, if you're going green, be an exhibitor or attend at the Gaylord Texan Resort and Convention Center, first-rate IEEE, on the social, economic, and political impacts of renewable energies, all under one roof in April. Early discounted exhibitor rates are available through this radio program by calling 214-329-4949. That's 214-329-4949, or link up at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Also this half hour, the very popular Voice of Reason. But first, from our busy newsroom, the science news headlines with Marissa Vittoles.
Former Microsoft CTO Nathan Myhrvold and researchers at Intellectual Ventures have designed a mosquito laser as a method for combating malaria. The cost-effective device can shoot down 50 to 100 mosquitoes a second, is assembled from commonly available technology, and originated from a Gates Foundation challenge to combat the disease, which causes upwards of 1 million deaths per year. By mixing virus-based vaccines with sugars and allowing them to dry on a simple filter, Nova Biopharma Technologies and Oxford University scientists have developed a way to keep vaccines stable for up to 4 months, even at tropical temperatures. If effective, this method could streamline vaccine storage and delivery, reduce waste, and improve vaccine efficacy in underdeveloped countries. IBM researchers have developed a prototype solar cell that uses common, cheap elements and an inexpensive manufacturing process, as published in the journal Advanced Materials. This may solve a barrier to development in the field, as solar cells have required rare elements and complex manufacturing processes. According to the journal Nature, researchers at Children's Hospital Boston have found that reprogramming skin cells using induced pluripotent stem cell technology can lengthen cell telomeres. The study provides insight into the enzyme telomerase, especially as it pertains to aging and cancer research. Marissa Vittoles reporting from Silicon Valley.
Okay, we're back in line with Chris McMurrow, telling about the robot competition at the IEEE Green Technology Conference in mid-April at the Gaylord Resort Convention Center and Hotel, sponsored by Encore. But do you see maybe getting man out of the manned spaceflight program and does all go to robot?
One of the things that's interesting is that, you know, the Mars rovers and stuff, they have a lot of onboard autonomous behaviors where they practically only get high-level commands from Earth, since it takes, I think, something like 7 minutes for the signal to reach there. So, you know, because of the latency in communication there, then this automatic, autonomous robotics are going to be a big part of that.
Well, Chris, you're completing your master's in computer science engineering, and I understand that you actually work for the University of Texas at Arlington in the Automation and Robotics Institute, Research Institute there. What is it that you do for them as far as a vocation?
Well, I do research in swarm robotics here. I've also worked a little bit with the Air Force over the summers, the last couple of years. And so we're sort of, fusing some swarm robotics ideas sort of from a high-level standpoint here, trying to implement that on real hardware. So one of the things that we're interested in doing is building real platforms that can do real tasks in the world, but also applying some of these more theoretical algorithm concepts that basically control the robots. And we're particularly interested in having teams of robots, not necessarily of all the same type, but, you know, many different types of robots that can sort of augment the abilities of the group and make them work in one cohesive unit. So that's a big area of research that we're working on here, and that a lot of universities are working on.
How long have you been doing that for that institute?
I've worked here for about 3 years. I started when I was an undergraduate, but in particular the swarm robotics, I've really started to get into this in the last year and a half or 2 years.
And where's this going to lead you as far as a career, and what could you tell other people about maybe career opportunities that they might find in robotics?
Well, it's a field that is really going to get big here in the next 10 years or more. Even in the short run, there's with the success that some of the military unmanned vehicles have experienced in these recent international conflicts, it's going to be a big deal, and not just for military purposes. So, I think the way our country tends to work sometimes with research is it starts with government, it starts with military, and it starts with that sort of industry, but they end up permeating the civilian market too, and that's what you're going to see here. And that's what particularly excites me is the search and rescue aspect of things. For instance, one of the ideas that we'd like to pursue is forest fire fighting, where if you think about it right now, a state like California has these forest fires that pop up all the time. And mm-hmm. since it's such a big area, it's really hard to mobilize trained firefighters from all over the country, because it actually requires thousands of men to get out there and fight these fires. But if we could have some sort of rapid response robotic-based system that, maybe you have a mixture of aerial vehicles that monitor the path of the fire, maybe they fuse that data with satellite imagery, and then maybe there's some ground robots or automated firefighting ground robots that can get out there and sort of, set up a front line, like a perimeter around these fires, and at least sort of hold the line for the human firefighters to get in there and finish the job. But if you can act quickly in these sorts of situations, whether it's search and rescue or firefighting or applications like that, it gives you a huge advantage, and that's something that unmanned systems can definitely address.
Well, the terrain is usually so rugged in these forest fire areas, and then you're not trying to tell me that these robots are not as sensitive to extremes in temperatures, either high or low, are you? Aren't they just susceptible like we are in their lenses and their sensors and other things?
Well, sometimes, but all of those can be designed for, and that's part of the challenge, is designing robots that are robust enough to perform in various hazardous environments, since the quote-unquote dull, dirty, and dangerous environments that humans don't want to go into. So there's been a lot of advances in building sensors that are smaller and more tolerant to things like heat and heat and water and things like that. So it's a field that's really going to start blossoming here. It's already, it's getting there, but I think you're going to see huge advancements in mobile robotics here in the next, decade.
Now, you're working pretty intensely there at ARRI, and what is this, I understand, on nanotechnology for medical applications? Are you involved with any of that?
No, I'm not directly involved with any of that, but there is a lot of interest in making these so-called nanorobots that would be able to enter the human body and do things that are really difficult for a doctor to do. For instance, right now, if you have a heart condition, they can put a stent in your heart if there's some sort of blockage, but that's really just sort of going in there and, putting in a tube that expands and sort of temporarily solves the problem. But one thing that a lot of doctors are talking about doing is having some sort of robot that can go in there and basically remove those blockages and kind of do repair work. And it's not just for the arteries, but, for various systems in your body, there's a lot of talk about doing that. There's also talk about sort of targeted drug delivery, where right now, sometimes if you get sick, like if you get an infection, then you take an antibiotic, and you generally take it, in the form of a pill. And that antibiotic, that medicine, goes throughout your entire body, but the infection may only be in one localized region. Mm-hmm. Well, it would be a lot better if we had some sort of way to sort of spot deliver those medications to the problem area in the body. That way, there's a lot less risk for complications and for rejection and things like that. If you're fighting an infection or you're trying to deliver some sort of medicine, not to the entire body, but rather to a particular location, and that's something that nanorobotics can do.
All right, Chris. If there was, if you had about 90 seconds on an elevator and you ran into somebody that wanted to know what you were all about and what you were doing, or a young person maybe starting a career, or any advice that you would want to give, what would you like to have be the takeaway from this this interview? What is the succinct thought you'd like to leave us with?
Well, I guess if you're going to put me on the spot like that, I'd just have to say that robotics is one of these fields that is really, there's so much potential for our country and for the world for good to be done. And it's a really hard field. It's emerging with lots of different engineering principles, but there's also this merging of different fields like medicine, politics, things like that, ethics that need to be considered. So robotics is one of those things that it's just really tough, and it requires people of all different trades to work on. So, I'd encourage young aspiring engineers to just, get into the math, get into the science, do your engineering studies. But also people that are who are from other fields who are interested in it, just try to learn as much as you can about the field, because what we're making as engineers are tools, and the tools are going to be there for the people who want to use them. So it's important that people just learn as much as they can about it.
Well, Chris, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being with us today. Chris McMurrow is completing his master's in computer science engineering. He's at the University of Texas at Arlington at the Automation and Robotics Research Institute. And he and Matthew Middleton are going to be organizing and are in the process of organizing the robotics competition at the IEEE Green Technology Conference that's going on in the middle of April this year. So if you want to go down and see all the neat things that are going on, you can tune in. So we appreciate it so much, Chris. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things we talk about a lot in this program is the aging infrastructure of this country, especially the power grid, and how it lets us down a lot and is going to let us down a whole lot more if we don't do something about it. A lot of people believe that private industry can't possibly modernize the way we need to, and it's going to take some help from government. But I'm onto a story where government stimulus money is being allocated to upgrade our power grid, but that there are so many strings attached that it isn't working. Now, I don't have the full details on this, but when I do, I'll give you the information and pass it along. And in the meantime, I want to introduce you to a guy by the name of David Welsh of OptiSense. He has developed some remarkable sensors. We can't tell you a whole lot about them right at the moment, but we will in the coming weeks. But in the meantime, I want him to give you kind of an overview about what we're talking about. These are sensors that go on the power grid and allow the electric companies to know where there's trouble. David, can you give us some examples about what we're talking about?
Well, I think probably for the layman that doesn't have a technical background, the easiest way to explain it is we'll put the sensors up, and then we will network them with a communications device of the customer's choice. I mean, we don't care if it's a satellite, a cell phone, a radio, but we have a digital set of electronics with each that is attached to each sensor at each three-phase location. So we actually broadcast the signal on whatever communications media that the customer requires, our request, and then we're able to put that into the internet. Subsequently, with the right passwords and logons, the customer at either his control station or on each one of his service trucks can pull up, and he can see each one of his power grids very similarly to the way you're used to seeing a road map. And he will see those sensors, and they're all color-coded. So subsequently, when everything in the system's operating as it is supposed to be operating as, the sensors will all be green. Now, let's say a tree limb grounds out a line or is touching the line. That sensor will change color, whatever color the customer wants. Typically, let's just say yellow. And that will give it's out of some tolerance that's also set by the customer. He can set it at plus or minus 5%, plus or minus 10%, plus or minus 20%, whatever he wants to set. It's in the software. So he can say, okay, I want to know when my system goes out of some tolerance, plus or minus, let's just use 5%. So that sensor will turn yellow. So he knows on that feeder, and there's only 5 million miles of feeders in the United States, unmonitored. So on that feeder, he will look and say, okay, I've got all these green sensors. Now here I've got two or three of them that are yellow. So he's starting to get an indication he probably has a problem. Now, when that thunderstorm moves through and you have a power surge, lightning strike, those sensors can turn another color. Let's say we turn them red this time, and that means the power's off. That gives the utility the chance to begin their response, and instead of trying to wait to get so many calls from customers saying, my power's off, and then trying to get their map out and say, okay, let's send trucks this direction, this direction, this direction, and we'll find that blown fuse or transformer that is malfunctioned, or truck that hit the electric pole and knocked it down. So they actually can increase their response time, get better service, and save a lot of money. So instead of sending three or four trucks, why don't you just send one? Instead of sending, if you have two people in each one of those trucks, you know, if you send four trucks, send eight people, send one truck and two people. So you become more efficient. And it should, we're hoping that it'll be a very good thing for the utilities. And what we've seen over the last couple of years of field trials, it appears that it's going to be that's going to be the case.
Well, you've already got a lot of, several key customers that have picked up on this and are installing these things right now. Do you expect a big rush to occur as we get more long transmission lines from wind and solar in the outlying areas?
Okay, Colonel, I kind of hate to go technical on you here, but there's really four distinct markets. Now, from West Texas, you really get power generation because your turbines are turning. Well, okay, that's the first market. And you have to monitor that type of equipment. Second market, you've got those big lines that are going to run all the way across the state. Those are transmission lines, and they'll be running above 100,000 volts. The next market's every line and feeder that runs through every neighborhood into every shopping center all throughout the United States, and that's what you call distribution. Those lines are 15,000 volts to 35,000 volts. And then the fourth market is the residential and industrial market, in other words, the end user. We are specifically today targeted at the distribution, the 15,000 to the 35,000 volt. Now, technically, can we address all four markets? The answer is yes, but as a young company, we're not trying to be everything to everybody. We have picked a market that is not served at all. All the large companies, and using other companies' names, but let's just go ahead and say General Electric, Siemens, ABB, they're all targeted right now today at providing the same solution at the transmission market, the above 115 kV market. So we as a small company, we picked a market niche that is not served today with our type of solution. There are mechanical devices that try and serve the market, but they have not enjoyed great success in penetrating the market.
Well,
I think you also asked if we anticipated seeing this to begin to gain acceptance, and the answer is yes. We've had two inquiries in the last 30 days from two different companies for 5,000 sensors each.
Okay.
Which for a small company would be a very nice production.
Well, it sounds like your market is large enough to keep you very busy for a good long time and through a whole lot of growth. Is that what you're saying?
Well, through the initial analysis and research that we did to determine our target market, we realized that with 5 million miles of lines unserved and no high technology solution to serve that market, that it was a much higher volume market than to look at transmission lines. Now, transmission lines, the other side of the coin, transmission lines pay a larger dollar value, but it's going to be minimal in quantity compared to the transmission market. The transmission market will be at least 10 times greater volume. I mean, the distribution market will be at least 10 times greater volume than the transmission market.
Wow, okay, fascinating. You've had quite a background, too. Did you working with Lockheed Martin for 20 years and on the F-16 program, is that what got you interested in sensors?
Well, when I was with Lockheed Martin, Lockheed Martin also ran several of the national laboratories. And because of my background with finance and MBA, I had put together several business plans to spin out technology from a national lab, the Idaho National Engineering and Environmental Laboratory in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Well, a lot of people don't realize that we have national labs that have 4,000 or 5,000 scientists sitting there doing research. And the United States military doesn't pick up the technology, it's normally just archived. So there's been some initiatives through the United States government to spin that technology out and commercialize it. So from my experience in the past, I was aware of these types of programs. So after my 20 years in corporate America, I started looking for a way to not only start a business, but also participate in that program. So the first technology I spun out of the National Lab was the technology that I took over to Greece, where we were trying to help them with unexploded ordnance that was in stores or landmines on the ground to clean up the environment.
Yeah, I was going to say, it looks like you took a little detour there in the year 2000, going over to Greece to manage. You were the managing director, I understand, of the Greek demilitarized company in Athens. Is that right?
Yeah, well, what happened is I put the business plan together for it, and then finally somebody turned around and said, well, who's going to run this thing? And they heard that I was leaving corporate America, and they said, well, why don't you come run it? And those cards all kind of fell into place, and I was happy to do that for them on a couple-year contract, and it was a wonderful experience, wonderful country, wonderful people, and wonderful food. It's just, it was a highlight of our lives. My wife and I really enjoyed the country.
Now, tell me, of course, you're fluid now in the language. Is that right, David?
We took Greek classes for 6 months, and we got to where we could order in a restaurant. And it was really interesting in rural restaurants, because what they do is they bring you a menu and a little white tablet with a pencil. So you get to write what you want for dinner.
Oh, boy.
So you had to not only speak a little Greek, you have to write a little Greek. So, but it was a wonderful experience.
And you get to be able to ask where the restrooms were and how to find a cab. I guess those are the other essentials, I think.
We could ask directions. Actually, my wife was much better at that. She's a teacher by background, so she learned the language and did rather well with it.
And then in 2001, you decided to take this other endeavor that you knew needed some help, and that's what put you in the sensor business for electrical transmission lines.
Well, I came into a situation where I had an exit option, and it just so happened that the National Lab called me because I'd worked with the people out there, and said, hey, David, you know, this technology you looked at 3 or 4 years ago, the U.S. military didn't pick it up, and it's available. If you'd like to fly out here and negotiate a deal, we'd be happy to sell it to you.
In a couple of weeks, David Welsh is going to have some dramatic improvements to this sensor system that we're going to talk about. We can't talk about it now, but we will in a couple of weeks, so stick around. And in the meantime, if you want to meet David Welsh, he's going to be featured at the Green Technology Conference, the IEEE Green Technology Conference. It's going on April 15 and 16. You can find out full details about that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz.
And now, we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
It's quite obvious that there's a lot of opportunities associated with climate change, renewable technologies, and so forth. Whether you're an engineer or a senior manager in a company or someone involved with industry, we're experiencing some exciting opportunities now. We're in it now, and there's opportunities to define how industries will behave or operate in a environment where climate change will need to be looked at seriously. So I see it as opportunity, development point of view, from an organisational development point of view, and also further improving environmental footprint on this planet called Earth. So exciting times. Yep, Michael Magalakis. From SSMI Group in Melbourne, Australia.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
Waiting for you.